Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join our Facebook group, the Ravenpuff Common Room, and on Instagram at the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/therambling ravenpuffs, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in. Grab your butterbeer and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Ravenpuffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're covering chapters 15 and 16 of Chamber of Secrets, Aragog, and the titular chapter, The Chamber of Secrets. In these chapters, Jess is delivered her worst fear of all time.
Amen to that. Oh my God.
And Lockhart's secret is exposed.
Oh man. Yes. Yeah. I had a really good time. I think we were talking off mic about work and things like that. And I'm like, I work with Gilderoy Lockhart. I should start calling these people Lockhart, because like that they are taking credit for what a lot of other people have done. I know that all too well.
Yes. And I regret to inform everyone that our original guest speaker, Morgan Chalfont, will not be able to join us. Like, he got busy working with the poet laureate, like at his university. Anyway, he's busy doing important English poetic things and could not be with us. But hopefully he'll join us again for a later episode.
I hope so too. It's always good to talk to Morgan.
Yeah, no, I just have to figure out which episode is gothic-y enough for him. I need to get him like with the Dementors or something.
Ooh, yeah, that would be a good one for him. Anything dark and weird, he's all about. So.
Exactly. But we have enough dark things to start with now. In chapter 15, Aragog. Preliminary thoughts?
So I always knew this was the spider book. Like, I knew this was the book that these guys would show up at. I mean, there's on the cover of the edition I have, there's a little guy hiding, and they kind of hint at it throughout the chapters before. So I knew it was coming, and still didn't like it when it showed up. Those are my initial thoughts.
Okay. But before we get to spiders, just general, like, panic and disarray, because it's basically been 2 weeks since Dumbledore and Hagrid have left.
Yeah, so things are a lot different at Hogwarts. I guess I could say that, because the kids are being escorted to each class by a teacher, which isn't really how things operate there.
No, not at all. Like, summer was creeping over the grounds around the castle. Sky and lake alike turned periwinkle, and flowers large as cabbages burst into bloom in the greenhouses. But with no Hagrid visible from the castle windows, striding the grounds with Fang at his heels, the scene didn't look right to Harry.
Yeah, they talk about the absence of Hagrid here a couple times, and it's sad, because, you know, I guess his presence being gone is makes an impression.
Yeah, and Harry thinks about, like, how are we even going to follow Hagrid's advice? There aren't any spiders left.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, eventually they kind of come up on these spiders. I'm trying to remember how they end up following, but they do follow them.
Yeah, but first we get one person, however, seemed to be thoroughly enjoying the atmosphere, of course, Draco Malfoy. And Malfoy's like, you know, why don't you become headmaster, Professor Snape? I'll tell Father you're the best teacher ever.
Yeah, the level of ass kissing in this scene was pretty disgusting. And Snape had always been kind of like, here, you know, like whatever, he was a presence. But here, when he's kind of like really eating up what Draco says, I was just like, oh God, it's really, I don't see Alan Rickman in these, you know, in these lines. I see the book version of Snape here.
Yeah, like my again, some people have gone on to say, like, I think Kevin included, that, you know, there are certain characters that were cast in Harry Potter that when you go back to read them, you can't see anything except that actor. Yeah, and for a lot, Alan Rickman, Snape is one of them.
Yeah, I think I saw him in that role up to this point, and then I kind of was like, this feels worse. And I remember when we've talked about him, you've said, like, this the book Snape is much more, like, blech than the movie one.
Like, I feel like, yeah, I think we talked about it before. Like, movie Snape, Alan Rickman, is caustic and sarcastic, mm-hmm. but book Snape is, like, cruel.
Yeah.
Rochester and Heathcliff.
Yeah, there we go. Great. Yeah, that is a great analysis.
And it's just interesting because, like, before, I never really thought about it, but Snape never struck me as the type to have any particular ambition in regards to this career. As you said, mm-hmm. he just kind of was a presence.
Yeah, it was kind of surprising to me that he didn't react like, oh, you know, calm down. But he was really flattered by that. And it doesn't ever seem like he's, like, gunning for Dumbledore's job.
No, he was always gunning for Defense Against the Dark Arts.
Yeah, so this is surprising.
Yeah, and it's extra unrealistic because Snape is, like, one of the, if not the absolute youngest member of staff.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because he right now, again, born in 60, 93, so he is 33 years old right now.
Oh, my goodness.
Like,
oh, my goodness.
Like, only 3 years older than me.
I was going to say, big week for you this week. So,
just got ugly ass kissing all around. Did not like it. And again, I didn't particularly think of Snape as having that sort of, like, academic / political ambition in this regard. But, you know, whatever. Just another way for Snape to be snaping it up.
Snaping it up. That's what he's good at, that seems like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, it's just, you know, Malfoy mouthing off about pity it wasn't Granger who died and Ron was, like, about to, like, whoop his ass. And so, you know, you told me that, you know, you know Harry and Ginny get together.
Yes.
You know who Ron gets together with, right?
I do. Yes, I do.
Okay. So just really thinking about it, because we don't see that much of it in Philosopher's Stone as much, but here we get to the point of, yes, she's a know-it-all bitch, but she's my know-it-all bitch.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, this was the other thing that kind of surprised me about this. I guess maybe Snape didn't hear Malfoy make this comment, because I feel like that comment would not have been taken lightly. Like, that he wished it was Hermione that had died or whatever. That seems like something that wouldn't be let go of easily, but here it kind of was dismissed.
Again, depends on how shitty we want to think of Snape is in our headcanon. That would Snape even be in a position to ignore such a blatantly terrible remark? And honestly, with book Snape, I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good point. But I did, I kind of, you know, like I said, I do know where two of these relationships are going. And I thought, okay, so we're kind of starting it's kind of starting there that he's getting so upset about what is being said about her. I mean, he kind of did that at the beginning of the book when he was called a mudblood. And I don't know, I feel like Draco likes to get him riled up, which that's not very cool.
Yeah. And then they go to Herbology, and it was nice that now Ernie's like, I'm sorry.
Yeah, good for Ernie. I'm glad he, you know, and thankfully Harry is kind of like, it's all good. And Ron is a little bit like, yeah, fine, but whatever. He's a little more defensive.
And it's just interesting, the notion of, I know you would never attack Hermione Granger. And so it's just the interesting notion, again, that, like, I'm not saying it was unreasonable for Ernie to suspect that. It's like, you know, it's like saying, oh, like, I'm not racist, I have black friends, you know?
Right, right, right.
So, just the idea that, you know, it seems counterintuitive, but yeah, it's perfectly possible that maybe Harry was the heir of Slytherin and he compartmentalized enough that, you know, Hermione's just a very, very, very special circumstance and screw all the other Muggleborns, but Hermione Granger's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That seems
that
like
is unfortunately a thing that people do sometimes.
That is a thing that people do, and it is doesn't make any sense. But it is very much something that we see in this world. Like, oh, but they're okay. It's like, oh my god, get it together.
Yeah, and but it's in Herbology that they finally catch the trail of the spiders again.
Yes. Okay. So they're messing around in Herbology and see the trail of spiders, and then Harry's like, we got to bust out that invisibility cloak tonight and follow this trail of spiders. And Ron, much like I would react, is kind of like, okay.
Yeah. And it, just a note that this will be Ron's first venture into the forest, because he didn't get busted, you know, smuggling Norbert out. That was strictly Harry, Hermione, and Neville. And Draco, by extension. Like, so he wasn't part of that little adventure. So the forest is brand new to him.
Yeah, very scary, too, for... well, I mean, I'm sure there's a bit of curiosity there, but, you know, we also know Ron doesn't like spiders, and the whole, like, reason for the journey is to follow a trail of spiders. So I'm sure he's already, like, not completely on board with this.
Yep. And then they head off to, of course, Lockhart's classroom. And Lockhart's like, why so sad? And it's like, you know, bitch, have you been watching, like, what's been going on the last few weeks? But, you know, with Hagrid gone, you know, Lockhart says, my dear young man, the Minister of Magic wouldn't have taken Hagrid if he hadn't been 100% sure that he was guilty, said Lockhart, in the tone of someone explaining that one and one made two. And it's just, you know, just especially in combination with, you know, the scene that we saw in the last chapter with Cornelius Fudge, that it's the sad naivete that, of course, you think a person in power would not dare, like, again, take that sort of drastic step unless they're 100% sure, because, again, it's like hell to play for a politician if you fuck up that badly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah, there's a little bit of... I think this was also a section that Lockhart's kind of, I guess I would say, lack of emotional intelligence. He's just kind of, you know, going about his Lockhart ways and isn't really thinking about the people around him. But politically as well, we do like to think that, I guess I like to think, when I say we, sometimes I mean I like to think that some people are, you know, doing it for the
decent
greater good.
People.
But yeah, I like to think people are decent. But that also has led to some instances of me being like, oh, I thought you were decent and you're truly an asshole. So
yeah. Well, I fall into that too. But it's not just, it's not that I want to think all people are just naturally good. I also fall into the trap of, you know, even if someone is not morally good and, you know, they won't do the right thing because it's morally the best thing to do, I fall into the trap of, okay, even if they're, you know, not very nice, at least they will do the right thing purely out of self-preservation to not cause trouble for themselves.
Yeah, one would think.
But then I'm proved time and time again that is not the case.
Yes, such is the life of a Hufflepuff, I guess. I don't know.
Yes, such is life. They find it harder and harder to sneak away because from six onwards, everyone's packed in all the dormitories. So the Gryffindor Tower, everyone's there. So they just have to wait and wait and wait, you know, for everyone to fall asleep.
Right. And they're playing some games with, I think, Fred and George. And then, you know, they're trying to throw, I thought this was kind of cute. They're trying to throw the game so they could get going on their business, but they just keep playing. And just reminds me of some game nights that I've been to.
What, didn't like it and tried to throw the game?
I've never done that, but just like when it's kind of like going on and you're just kind of like, I'm not having fun anymore, but somebody else is still like, oh, you know, when you like maybe typical being, I just want to go home and like go to bed, but somebody else.
Yeah, I tend to fall into those. I always liked card games more so than board games, and just like things like hearts and things like that. They're long, but at least they have like a limit that if you hit 100 points or whatever, like it's done.
Yeah, that's a good. I need a good ending there. I don't like these games that go on forever. But yeah. So that's what made me think of it. And then they get under the invisibility cloak and head on to the Forbidden Forest,
taking a pit stop at Hagrid's hut to get Fang.
Yeah, smart move. Maybe kind of. Well,
although he doesn't end up being a great deal of help. like not a vicious guard dog in any way, shape, or form?
No, he does not. I mean, no, I think the intentions were good and it was a smart move, but they didn't really know what they were up against. So.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so they start walking around in the forest following the spiders. And what they first come across is not the spiders. What did you think of the reemergence of the car?
I thought that was pretty funny. And that it was even more funny that it was like it had gone feral. Like, oh, the car's wild. It just, I don't know. That was just something else to me. Thankfully, they found the car because that shows up later on. But pretty funny.
Just, again, just the whole notion of like what level is something like sentient, or is it better to compare something like the car to like AI?
That's a good. Yeah, I'm assuming, I don't know. It was a little strange because, you know, here we already have this muggle object that has been enchanted. And then now it's like sentient or something. I don't know. But
well, yeah, like magic, like technology, like what point does it start to have a soul?
I don't know. But this, thank God for this flipping car. That's all I will say. I mean, thank goodness that this is. They, you know, it was not as much as I think I've ragged on the flying the car. It sure turned out to be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. But what happens after the car?
So then we're following the trail of spiders, and then we encounter, if I remember correctly, a big spider. Like we come
big
up to the
spiders that hoist them in the air by their feet.
Yes. Yes. And I definitely read this, but I blocked it out already. And then take them to an even bigger spider in a place full of spiders.
And so the spiders start calling Aragog. He called Aragog. What is it? He said. Men, clicked the spider who had caught Harry. Is it Hagrid? Said Aragog, moving closer. His 8 milky eyes wandering vaguely. Strangers! Kill them, clicked Aragog fretfully. I was sleeping.
Ugh. Yeah, this is, for anybody that's arachnophobic like me, this is like the worst, the absolute worst chapter. But
another Game of Thrones reference, the voice of Aragog is Grandmaester Pycelle.
Oh, wow. Okay. It's been so long since I've seen the movie, and I probably covered my eyes during this whole scene. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, and they didn't use CGI. They used, like, animatronics for this.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, that had to be kind of cool looking then.
Yeah. So Harry's like, we're friends of Hagrid's. That's the only thing that prompts Aragog to inquire further. And Harry explains that Hagrid's been taken.
Yeah, and then Aragog kind of tells the story of how Hagrid saved him in the Chamber of Secrets, and that, you know, this was Hagrid was taking care of him as a little baby spider. Aw, not really. And when he was in an egg and feeding him and helping him out, and then basically some stuff went down and Hagrid was protecting him. So he let him off into the forest. But also this is, you know, the Harry and Ron kind of put together like, oh, maybe he wanted us to, well, that's later, but maybe we didn't, you know, maybe Hagrid wanted us to know that this definitely wasn't him. Like this, he had nothing to do with this whole situation. A girl did die, but not because of this crazy spider.
Yeah, well, I think it was the sense that with Dumbledore gone, Hagrid himself gone, the only one who had any sort of information at this point was Aragog.
Right. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
And so they say, and you didn't come from the Chamber of Secrets, said Harry. I, said Aragog, clicking angrily, I was not born in the castle. I came from a distant land. A traveler gave me to Hagrid when I was an egg. Hagrid was only a boy, but he cared for me. Hidden in a cupboard in the castle, feeding me on scraps from the table.
Hagrid has a good heart.
So you never attacked anyone? Never, croaked the old spider. It would have been my instinct, but out of respect for Hagrid, I never harmed a human. The body of the girl who was killed was discovered in a bathroom. I never saw any part of the castle but the cupboard in which I grew up. Our kind like the dark and the quiet.
I mean, this is all fine and good, and I'm glad he makes this promise to Hagrid, but, like, obviously he doesn't really intend on keeping it now. So,
no, not now. But to be fair, he was in a sense, like, in human territory, even though Hagrid put them here. And now in his own sort of, you know, sense of ethics, like, you're on my turf now.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he also brags about having a bunch of little spiders because what is his lady's name? He gets a lady too.
Mossag?
Is that her? Okay.
Yeah. He even found me a wife, Mossag. Yes. And you can see how our family has grown all through Hagrid's goodness.
Thanks, but no thanks there, Hagrid.
The thing that lives in the castle, said Aragog, is an ancient creature we spiders fear above all others. Well, do I remember how I pleaded with Hagrid to let me go when I sensed the beast moving about the school. What is it? Said Harry urgently. We do not speak of it, said Aragog fiercely. We do not name it. I never even told Hagrid the name of that dread creature, though he asked me many times.
So we still don't know. I mean, now I know because I've read the next chapter, but we still don't know what this thing is that everybody's afraid of. Even the big, scary spider.
Yeah, like I said, like even this huge ass spider is utterly terrified of this thing. And not even a sense of, oh, I was a baby back then, I was defenseless. Like even now, it's like that scares the shit out of me.
Yeah, it's got to be pretty gnarly for it to be, for this crazy spider to be, for it to scare him. And then he says, so they kind of back down a little bit, or, you know, they talk about this and Harry said he doesn't want to press the subject. And then he's like, okay, well, we're going to bounce. And he's like, Aragog says, go? I think not. My sons and daughters do not harm Hagrid on my command, but I cannot deny them fresh meat when it wanders so willingly into our midst. Goodbye, friend of Hagrid. And therefore, every arachnophobe's fear just has been realized in that paragraph. But again, thankfully, Mr. Weasley's car came thundering down the slope, headlights glaring, horns screeching, knocking spiders aside. Several were thrown onto their backs, basically coming to save Harry, Ron, and Fang. Let's not forget about poor Fang.
Oh, poor Fang. So traumatized. Like,
yes.
He just wanted to walk. He just wanted to walk like a good boy.
Yes. Poor guy.
Yeah. And it's just interesting, the notion of maybe he, like, again, thinking that people do the right thing for pragmatic reasons. Like, Aragog may not give a crap about Ron or Harry, but maybe he's like, go tell them up at the school that Hagrid is innocent. Like, or, you know, do, like, be my messenger. Do something.
Right. Yeah. He, at some point, he's just like, he doesn't care. It's like,
he doesn't care. Again, which is, like, shows, in a roundabout way, shows how great his loyalty to Hagrid is, because he's willing to let Hagrid rot in Azkaban.
Right. You're exactly right. It's just kind of like, I guess if he's
your homie who did you such a solid, and like now he's like, yeah, I don't care.
Yeah, I don't care. You guys look like dinner, so we're just gonna go with that. Hagrid will be, you know, whatever, and then move on about our lives. So.
Or we might make the challenge that maybe Aragog is like, has some dementia.
I think we could go with that. I think that would be good.
And part of it, I think, because he's like, that was years ago. Like, maybe he's mixing up. Like, he doesn't like fully grasp that. Like, this actually is a whole new round. I don't know.
Maybe.
So, trying to be fair to Hagrid, be fair to Aragog, because he's getting on in years.
He is a little old. He has lots of friends, children that can, his legacy will live on. So he's made sure of that.
Yep. As we saw, the Mr. Weasley's car basically rescues them.
Yeah. Thank God for that crazy car.
No, it's sad. I kind of wish the centaurs could have shown up as well.
Yeah. You know, in a world of like mythical, magical creatures and things like that, the car was kind of, I mean, I'm glad it was there to help him out, but it would have been a little more fun if it was.
I want to see Ferenczi again.
I do too. I miss him.
Yeah, like we will see him in in future books, but I do wish he was developed more as a supporting character than he was.
Yeah, I like those Rudy Stargazers. Isn't that what Hagrid called them?
And then so Ron's like, first of all, Ron ends up throwing up in the pumpkin patch.
I don't blame him. They have been through some trauma right there.
Follow the spider, said Ron weakly, wiping his mouth on his sleeve. I'll never forgive Hagrid. We're lucky to be alive. I bet he thought Aragog wouldn't hurt friends of his, said Harry. That's exactly Hagrid's problem, said Ron, thumping the wall of the cabin. He always thinks monsters aren't as bad as they're made out. And look where it's got him, a cell in Azkaban.
I'm glad they had this conversation, because I was like, after, you know, Aragog's like, yeah, just go for it, take care of him. I'm like, what the hell was Hagrid thinking? But he probably was thinking like, oh, Aragog would be fine. They know Hagrid. They're like, oh, it's fine. You know, name dropping Hagrid was going to save him, and then totally almost didn't. So as I've said at the beginning of the chapter, I'm definitely on Ron's side in this chapter. I am I am terrified and glad to be free of that place.
So Harry is stewing and stewing, and he keeps thinking about what Aragog said. And it finally clicks in his mind that he tells Ron, Aragog said that the girl who died in a bathroom. What if she never left?
Mm-hmm. Good old Moaning Myrtle.
Exactly. Did you think of Moaning Myrtle beforehand?
Not before that encounter. When he said the girl in the bathroom, I'm like, well, obviously it's Moaning Myrtle, probably. But not up until that point, no.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And thus concludes chapter 15. So, I don't think we can move on without just talking about the general symbolism of spiders.
Please do.
I don't know. It's just there's such a staple in fantasy or, you know, whatever, you know, sci-fi literature as being the ultimate, like, evil and manifestation of our worst fears.
And as much as, like, I think I've mentioned, it's just not my favorite thing to encounter. Not my favorite of Mother Nature's creatures to run into, but I understand the purpose. If I'm looking at them in less of a like malicious way, there's a, you know, I have been taught to associate a spider with creativity or, you know, creation because of their web building skills, and kind of the cool things they do there. But appearances, so when I was a kid, there was a movie called Arachnophobia that was very popular. And I think it was in the early 90s. I never saw it for obvious reasons. But in literature, and I'll be honest, I may have avoided some of it. But you had mentioned kind of in literature, the spiders in Lord of the Rings and how
There's only one.
Okay. And I remember that. I don't remember the name you mentioned, and I'm sorry.
Shelob.
What is Shelob's role in Lord of the Rings?
Shelob's role is her lair is very close to Mordor, where they're trying to get to. And so it's like it's one of the places they have to go through to like avoid like the wall and the gates of Mordor to go to find this roundabout path to get to Mount Doom.
Okay, is she's like a gatekeeper? She kind of
She's not necessarily a gatekeeper. She doesn't work for anyone. She's just there. Like okay. She doesn't answer to the orcs or anything. She's just there.
Is she a malevolent presence or?
Jane is quite malevolent in the sense that, you know, just because they show up, you know, and she does not speak.
Oh, okay.
She doesn't talk. So she's just a really big spider who attacks our hero. And basically I'm not sure how it is in the book, but at least in the movie of Lord of the Rings, you know, Frodo gets his, you know, ass kicked and gets like petrified or like sedated by her venom, but it doesn't kill him. And it gets to a point where Sam has to come in and be the hero. And I don't think he kills Shelob, but you know, he fends her back so that he can take Frodo.
Okay.
But yeah, she is like the only I haven't read Lord of the Rings yet. I have a really nice set of like special edition from 1980 that I know is like worth $200 that I found at Goodwill. So it's sitting on my bookshelf waiting to be read, But the only thing I've read of Tolkien is the Silmarillion.
Oh, and yeah, so, I've heard that.
And so, yeah, and so I vaguely remembered that, again, Shelob, like, wasn't the first giant spider. There was, like, another big spider that she, like, descended from. But I don't know the whole mythos around that.
Interesting. Interesting that like, the appearance. I can't think of any other, and I'm sure there's, like, a really obvious one that I'm missing in just literature or popular movies and things like that. But I can't place it. Ugh. I don't know. Right. And like I said, I probably just have avoided it or blocked it out.
Yeah. Have you ever had the giant spider dream?
Oh, I don't know if I've had a giant one, but I've definitely, they have been present in, I've just had a really horrible dream recently. And I can't remember, that might have been the thing. Have you?
Yes. When I was a kid, so I don't know what prompted it, but basically I remember my bedroom was right across the hallway from the staircase going to the downstairs of my house. And it was a full on like Aragog sized spider, climbing up the stairs. And I'm like, mom, there's a spider in the house. And my mom's like, oh, don't worry, honey. Like one of the cats will get it. And then it's eating my cat, Cindy.
Oh, no. Oh, my God. I would be traumatized. That's horrible.
Yeah, so that was my one and only giant spider dream, but I still remember it quite vividly.
I can imagine. It'll probably happen tonight. I'm sure it'll happen. It's just been one of those. I don't know why, and I also, so in this world, I do like how they kind of pit two of people's biggest like fears in nature against each other. I think that's really interesting, or the fact that those two creatures are at odds with each other, because
yes. That is interesting, because again, it is, as we learn in chapter 16, like two of the most wild creatures, like again with snakes it's more concrete in history and sociology because of the Adam and Eve story, and we so often equate the snake with, you know, Lucifer and the devil and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. And, you know, which is interesting is, like, I'm not going to go out and, like, seek a snake out to be. I don't have one as a pet. That's just, like, not really my thing. But I have, like, held one of those big snakes without a lot of concern, you know. And so I don't know why I feel like it's not, I'm not alone in that. Like, some people have a real aversion to one or the other. So I think pitting them against each other or them having this rivalry in this world is pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely like prefer snakes over spiders. Like if I have to touch one or the other, I take the snake.
Ooh, me too. Easy.
Like you, I also consider thinking of the spider as being more a symbol of creativity.
It has taken me a while to like symbolically see that. Now in this particular story, I don't know if that, I know, I mean, I would have to sit with it and kind of really take that.
Nah, I don't really see it either. Like, and also the notion of destiny.
Okay. I don't know about that with spiders.
Well, just the idea of like the three fates in Greek mythology and they're like, you know, spinning wheel of thread, like weaving the destinies. So the way that spiders weave the web, like, you know, some people, you know, make allusions to destiny and fate in that regards.
Okay, that makes sense.
Which I have done because I don't know if I'll ever use her in a novel, short story, whatever, but I have this figure in my head called Arume Kami, who basically, she's kind of like this goddess of destiny who's very geisha-inspired, Japanese-inspired, where she's like in this kimono, but she has like four spider legs out of her back, and again, the weaving of destiny.
That sounds like a cool creature.
But that's all I can really say on, you know, the spiders, because nothing really at play here, just that we want to get something really terrifying, and even the thing we've yet to face is even terrifying to the terrifying spiders.
Yeah, which is, I appreciate that. The terrorizing things terrorizing each other.
Yep. And thus we move on to chapter 16, The Chamber of Secrets. Finally. All those times we were in the bathroom and she was just three toilets away, said Ron bitterly at breakfast.
So they had spent all this time looking for spiders escaping the girls' bathroom when it's just kind of like, now we're having to go in there anyway. Also, the extra weight with this whole adventure, they thought they were going to get out of the exams this year. Not so much. They're still having exams.
Yes, and what does McGonagall say? The whole point of keeping the school open at this time was for you to receive your education, she said sternly. The exams will therefore take place as usual, and I trust you are all studying hard. Like, how can the poor kids study under these conditions?
I don't know. That's a big ask of kids. Being that as an adult, sometimes I'm like, I can't handle stuff. So if people are getting petrified and there's this chamber of secrets, nobody knows about it, that's a lot. That's a lot to ask from kids. But I guess assuming it's a distraction.
Going back to the notion again, the bodily harm of what these kids can take. So, in our society, we have, stigmas around like mental illness and stuff that, if they don't see it in a physical ailment, like they don't take it seriously, maybe it's even worse because they can withstand so much physical bodily harm that maybe even the diminishing of mental illness is even worse in the wizarding world.
Maybe. They ask a lot of these kids.
Professor Dumbledore's instructions were to keep the school running as normally as possible, and that, I need hardly point out, means finding out how much you have learned this year.
So the petrified students, which we talk about and soon, I hope they get exempt from these exams because, like, they haven't been in class. I don't know.
Like, Colin hasn't been in class since November.
Yeah. Man, and Hermione, she was in the hospital wing, but she was having things she was still working.
Yeah, like she's only just like missed out. Like she was still doing her homework with the cat incident.
Yes, the cat incident. Oh, well, everybody's pretty excited about this because they hear that Dumbledore's coming back, and then they're excited because they're like, Quidditch is back. We've got the heir of Slytherin. It's like, we don't have to talk to Moaning Myrtle. It's like, not so much.
Well, no, it doesn't say that Dumbledore is coming back.
Dumbledore's several people, I have good news. Oh, they were just shouting this out at each other, trying to guess what the good news was, I think.
Yes. And finally, they got it that, the Mandrake concoction is ready so that everyone will be unpetrified and hopefully they'll be able to glean who their attacker was.
Yes. Okay. So at the same point, Jenny Weasley is coming over to try to talk to Ron. After all this kind of hullabaloo, she's trying to talk to Ron and she's being a little cagey about it.
Yep. And she's like, and Harry like is like, is this about the Chamber of Secrets? Did you see something? And before she can say anything, Percy comes over and just steals her spot.
Yeah, and he's kind of like, she kind of runs away. She said she had something important to tell them, but Percy. And then Percy gets called out for doing something. I think I know what Percy's up to. And
what is Percy up to?
He's got a girlfriend. That's what I think's going on. Because he's had these issues since the beginning that they were giving him a bad time for, like, hiding in his room or something. So I think he has a lady friend.
Oh, a lady friend. But, yeah, and it's, in a way, this kind of shows how, like, maybe he's just working out of context. He didn't, like, see Ginny's face of how upset she was. But this is kind of, like, very egocentric of Percy to think that, oh, it's not about the Chamber of Secrets. Like, it was just me doing whatever.
I guess, yeah, just kind of assuming she's just a kid and she doesn't know what
the hell is. Like, yeah, just assuming that she doesn't know anything or doesn't see anything,
Right. Very rude, Percy. Come on.
Yep. Alrighty then.
So, yeah.
I'm just looking around what happens. Well, first, they were kind of thinking, okay, maybe we won't have to go to see Moaning Myrtle after all. But the opportunity actually, presents itself because they're able to flatter Gilderoy Lockhart into abandoning them in the corridor because Lockhart thinks that all this precaution is a waste of time.
Yeah, I don't really understand why. Well, I haven't figured out what the hell's going on with him yet. I know he doesn't know what he's talking about, and we figured that out pretty quickly. But some of his behavior is a little suspect to me still. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then this is where McGonagall, they run into Lockhart, and then they're kind of like trying to play all innocent. We're just going to go see Hermione and tell her what's up. And then McGonagall is so moved.
I thought this was so mean of manipulating McGonagall's emotions.
It felt
yucky. I didn't like it.
I didn't either. But and because
she and they hear thing. Her, and as she's going down the hallway, like she turns the corner, and they hear her blowing her nose.
I know. And what a bunch of how very rude. But I guess it got them what they needed to do. Even though later on, I think. Who's it say, Madame Pomfrey? There's just no point talking to a petrified person. And I'm sure McGonagall knew that, but she's probably like, oh, these poor kids, they're so sweet. And just let them go.
And for Madame Pomfrey, like, I don't know if this is indicative of her normal bedside manner, but show a little more tact.
Right.
It's like when you go to your loved ones in a coma and you tell them, like, they can't hear you, you know?
Right. Yeah. Like, back off a little bit, you know. It's beyond any sort of logic. It's just, yeah, anyway, I thought that was a little cold of her too, but
it's good that they did get this diversion, because as they're visiting Hermione, they realize something is stuck in her like clenched fist. And why didn't Madame Pomfrey or anyone else notice this?
I think that's a great question. I wondered that myself. And then I guess
the only thing you can think of is that they just, you know, petrified and just glazed over it. And then the first thing they thought about was, you know, the girl who was with Hermione, they saw her mirror. So I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I guess it just, again, when you think about like petrification, like, would it be necessary? Would they even think to like do a thorough like search of the body? I don't know. Like, this comes up a lot as being a big, big plot hole.
That's interesting, because I kind of wondered that myself. And it was like, I don't think they would, especially all the like unknowns around here. If somebody is clenching a piece of paper, you know, there usually is a reason. I mean, and if it was like a love note to friggin' Ron or something, I mean, they would have just been like, okay. I don't think they're that respectful of the student's privacy that they're like, well, we can't read their letters, you know, whatever.
Or the only thing to think of is that they just generally thought it was clenched like in fear or whatever.
That they probably couldn't remove it or something like that too. I know they have a hard time pulling it.
But the only thing is that this piece of paper was so scrunched up in her fist that only Harry and Ron giving Hermione her full undivided attention did they notice it. Which is, I guess, kind of, you know, makes sense, because Madame Pomfrey just said a page ago, like, there's no point talking. So, like, you're like, oh, they're petrified, put them on a bed and leave them there until a mandrake potion is ready.
This is a strange, strange part. But we do learn what is lurking in Hogwarts.
Like, and did you know that it was a snake before this chapter?
No, I did not. I knew basilisk was something that showed up sometime, but I did not know. No, I didn't.
Yeah. So what do you think of this, and how it all explains that only Harry hears it because it's speaking Parseltongue?
Well, I originally thought the voice was Voldemort, which I was wrong. It was this snake, and it makes sense what he's saying too. Very snake-like things. Now, if there's a connection with Voldemort, there might be. I don't know yet. Forgive me. This is the first time I'm reading this book. Now, I thought I highlighted spiders flee before the basilisk, for it is their mortal enemy. That was where I kind of was like, oh, interesting little thing there. But I think it's kind of a cool monster to have because of the way it can travel, which is through the pipes of the school, and kind of terrifying, just especially if you're a person who doesn't like snakes, you know, to think about that. Like, following a trail of spiders sounds horrible to me. I mean, a snake in a pipe sounds horrible just as a person that's kind of like whatever about them. But I don't know any sort of like serpent lore. I don't know anything. I'm not well versed in like snake symbolism and things like that.
Well, it's just interesting that the name of this giant snake is a basilisk, because a basilisk is a term used in mythology, but it's not necessarily a snake.
Oh, I didn't know that.
There have been, like, a basilisk has sometimes been described as, like, this crazy chicken thing with dragon wings. It's, like, really, really trippy.
Yeah, sounds weird. Okay.
Like, and in a way, some of that is hinted at, as it says, like, the basilisk here is born, like, as the egg of a chicken hatched under a toad.
Okay. Yeah, they were real specific about that. I thought that was a little strange.
Yeah, and which was why all Hagrid's roosters were, like, throttled.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Ugh. Yeah, like, Wikipedia. A basilisk is a legendary reptile reputed to be a serpent king, which can cause death with a single glance. Okay, this is passing out the basilisk. According to Naturalist Historia, the basilisk of Cyrene is a small snake being no more. Okay. Well, I guess it's how you're defining serpent, but yeah, like, even this little picture of a basilisk, like, it has a chicken's head, but, like, the rest of it is, like, very scaly and serpentine. It can be really weird depending on which folkloric thing you're referencing.
Yeah, it's bringing up some pretty wild imagery on online. They got, like, a chicken head and I don't know. Wow. Okay. Pretty interesting creature.
And I just want to say that in this world, there must be a great many types of curses or maybe animals that can cause petrification, because the fact that none of the teachers could figure this out.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and that this creature is not known, or that they didn't.
And I think also maybe the idea that maybe its ability to petrify isn't very well known, because what it's known for is that if you look it straight in the eye, you die. So whereas, like, I guess I'm sure there's not been probably as many instances where the victim, like, looked at the basilisk indirectly, like, as Harry pointed out,
right.
Colin saw it through his camera.
Right.
Justin saw it through the ghost, nearly headless Nick. Yeah, very creative. And then Hermione and the Ravenclaw girl saw it with her mirror.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting takes on that. And then Mrs. Norris.
Yeah, and even Mrs. Norris only saw it because the bathroom had flooded and only saw the basilisk reflection in the water.
What a weird creature. And also, thank goodness that these people have not looked it in the eye.
And so they are like, what are we going to do? Like, should we tell someone? And they agree to go to the staff room.
Yes. And this was kind of interesting, because the staff of Hogwarts are having a whole conversation where they basically kind of do something that I thought was funny and kind of say, okay, Lockhart, you're such a badass. Why don't you go figure this out? And they kind of are all on board with kind of
I think it's the accumulation of we're so sick of this dude.
Yeah. It just kind of surprised me, because there are so many instances in this series so far that the professors take the kind of high road. And in this one, it's kind of like, we are sick of this guy's shit. We are not going to take the high road. You go figure it out since you're so cool. And then he's like, oh, yeah, of course. And, you know, he's obviously freaking out.
Yeah, because who's the one who starts it? Is it Snape who starts it?
I am trying to figure that out, too.
Yeah, well, first, they've all met there because a student has been kidnapped.
Right, right. And it says
not just any, but a pureblood, which kind of goes against the usual pattern of the attacks.
Right. And that her skeleton will lie in the chamber forever.
And Professor Flitwick burst into tears. That's so sweet.
It is sweet. Then we put together that it is none other than Jenny Weasley, and Ron freaks. Basically, slides down onto the wardrobe floor beside him.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it is Snape who starts it. Just the man, he said. The very man. A girl has been snatched by the monster, Lockhart. Taken into the Chamber of Secrets itself. Your moment has come at last. And then Professor Sprout pitches in. And then Professor Flitwick gets on the bandwagon. And then McGonagall. So yeah, they all decide, like, we are sick of this dude.
And it's funny because, like, we know of the instance with Professor Sprout where Lockhart comes in and it's like, I mean, I'm not trying to tell anybody what they need to do. But so it's just, frustration.
It's one thing for Snape or even, like, McGonagall, who is very, like, rigid and no nonsense. But I think it says a lot that you know, Professor Sprout, who's head of Hufflepuff, we're all warm and fuzzy. But it's known throughout the series that Professor Flitwick is very kind and very, very sweet. And so the fact that he can turn this petty says a lot about how much Lockhart has been digging under everyone's skin.
Yeah, when you start pissing off the nice people, you're definitely doing something.
Yeah. Yeah, don't mess with Hufflepuffs or Ravenclaws.
No.
Or Ravenpups.
No. Especially Ravenpups.
And so Gildor is like, okay, I'll just be in my office getting ready. And he leaves. Right, said Professor McGonagall, whose nostrils were flared. That's got him out from under our feet. So I guess the question is, do they honestly expect Lockhart to try in his delusions of, you know, his sense of self-importance, or do they expect him to run? Or do they, the teachers, even care at this point as long as he's out of the way?
I wondered that as well, because it's kind of like they're throwing him to the wolves or to the giant snake in a way. So, and I think at this point, they're not really sure what they're throwing him to, right? There's still this unknown.
Yeah, no, like for all they don't know, yeah, like, it's interesting. It's interesting because I guess as adults and, you know, we're, you know, Harry and Ron are like listening to all this through like the cupboard. Right. And so the teachers, you know, acknowledge that all of this was sarcastic, but the kids like are just like, okay, there's nothing we can do except maybe try and help Lockhart. So that's what they do.
Right. Right. So I just don't know what I don't know if they were trying to, you know, if they were doing this thinking that he would run off or thinking that he might make an attempt. And I kind of lean toward they think he might go out there and try just to see, you know, because the thing is, I think playing to his ego, if he were to do something by accident, it would be a pretty big win for him. But also yeah, he's a little.
It's this whole thing. There's this huge dichotomy between the person himself and his books. And so again, the teachers aren't in a position like the same as the students that, you know, okay, maybe he's a really, really arrogant pain in the ass. And maybe he, like, again, steps on all of our toes and tries to do all of our subject. But maybe he actually does know a few things, even though he doesn't, like, stick to his particular niche and acknowledge that that is his niche and that's the only thing he's good at.
Right, right.
So, yeah, we don't know. So, ultimately, you know, neither Harry or Ron are very enthusiastic, but they just want to be doing something because they can't bear the thought of, you know, all Fred, George, and Percy, all of them are sulking because their sister has been taken to the bowels of hell.
Right, right. Yeah, they're freaking out. And then, you know, some people, it's kind of interesting that they display the various reactions. Some people, you know, are sulking. Some people are doing what Ron and Harry do. It's like, okay, we need to do something. We have to move on this. And their way of going about that is going and checking on Gilderoy Lockhart to see what's going on. And he's in a panic, putting things away.
You mean you're running away? Said Harry disbelievingly. After all the stuff you did in your books? Books can be misleading, said Lockhart delicately. You wrote them, Harry shouted. My dear boy, said Lockhart, straightening up and frowning at Harry, do use your common sense. My books wouldn't have sold half as well if people didn't think I'd done all those things. No one wants to read about some ugly old Armenian warlock, even if he did save a village from werewolves. He looks so dreadful on the front cover, no dress sense at all, and the witch who banished the banded banshee had a hair lip. I mean, come on. Honestly, I will say I really enjoyed how the two actors, Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grant, and Kenneth Branagh played this scene.
Oh, I'll have to see it. I haven't watched it because I went recently in the recent past, since I don't want to spoil anything for myself. But
well, it's just the ideal. A lot of people, you know, harp on, you know, Daniel Radcliffe and the others, you know, just because the nature of them being kids and not being very good actors. But with, I don't know, like particularly with this scene with Kenneth Branagh, I think they sold it.
I will have to find out. That's pretty interesting. I just love this whole encounter because, like I said, it reminds me of just how different things work in the world. And, you know, Harry says incredulously, so you've been taking credit for what a load of other people have done? Harry, said Lockhart, shaking his head impatiently. It's not nearly as simple as that. There was work involved. I had to track these people down, ask them exactly how they managed to do what they did. Then I had to put a memory charm on them so they wouldn't remember doing it. It's like, oh, that's how he wrote all these books. So, and I just, you know, on a much smaller scale in everyday life, I have been witness to some of that Gilderoy Lockhart behavior.
Yeah. And if, you know, that's one thing is, if there's one thing I pride myself on, it's my memory charms. No, it's been a lot of work, Harry. It's not all book signings and publicity photos, you know. You want fame, you have to be prepared for the long, hard slog. And so it's just interesting, this sense of, yes, there's work involved in it. And he thinks that itself justifies the fact that he's getting credit for specifically something else that he thinks right. He can swap in his, again, great talents with memory charms. Again, it's just interesting, you know, this is not the first time I've thought this, you know, revisiting Lockhart. Why couldn't he use his, like, memory charms for the good guys or for good purposes?
Right. Yeah. Why not use his, like, I guess he's just too much in his ego or too self-serving to.
Yeah. Because again, the notion of memory charms, that is very powerful and very useful, because again, the way that the Ministry of Magic and this whole society has to keep one step ahead of the Muggles discovering anything. So this talent is marketable.
So he probably could have done something different, but instead he was just taking credit.
Yeah, like, I don't know if it's like, you know, maybe, again, just working with the ministry wasn't good enough for him, didn't satisfy his ego, or he thought, you know, just the idea of, you know, the normal, like, modifying the memories of Muggles was beneath him. Because, again, Lockhart, as I mentioned with in another episode, he's a half-blood, so he had Muggle siblings.
Okay.
And so he always, and that partly fueled his ego of thinking he's so much better than them.
One thing he has is an ego, but I think it's also really interesting to show how this whole notion of, I'm kind of stuck on this part, but taking credit for other people's work can bite you in the ass, ultimately. You know, he is, now this stuff has gotten really, really real. And he can't perform. So,
and the only reason, the only reason he's been able to keep it up as long is that he doesn't like seek out like notable like British wizards like in the country. He goes off to Armenia and like other places where that, you know, not that those people don't have their own networks, but he can come back to England and no one knows these people.
Right. I think that's something that I've seen people that have kind of a similar methodology and how they work. It's always like making sure they're just a little bit ahead of them, or somebody, you know, kind of, I guess it's a skill in its own, playing people and playing circumstances rather than just actually knowing what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah, like, because the closest thing I've come to thinking about that, or like a real life example, is of course with the, you know, Insta poetry, and you know, I have a whole podcast devoted to that, go check it out, Insta Poetic Justice. But the idea that naturally with people sharing their work, that has opened the, you know, floodgates to plagiarism. And a lot of articles that I've read specifically about Insta poetry plagiarism, again, it transcends countries and continents, where a person will take someone, like, you know, a person from America will take a poem from an Australian author, just try and take it and, you know, put it in a new market so it won't be as readily discovered.
That's too bad. I mean,
I wouldn't say prevented me, but it has made me pause to consider, like, how much, like, not that I don't love the Insta poetry thing, but I've thought about, like, I don't want people stealing my stuff. So I think I'm very limited in the full poems I post on Instagram anymore. And I prefer the strategy of just like a few lines, and then the rest of it will be in like one of my poetry collection.
That's a good way to do it, because I mean, then it's harder for people to plagiarize. I think, as with art and all kinds of things, I know artists really work hard to combat that, and I'm sure poets do as well, on a platform like Instagram, and on a smaller scale in work. It's just, I feel like it's, you know, some people just, if you're working on a project with other people and one person just decides like to take all the credit, just how demoralizing that can be for your coworkers. And thus, you would have a reaction like the other Hogwarts professors. When it comes down to it, that person, when the kind of the situation goes sideways, it's kind of like, yeah, good luck there, buddy. Hope you have fun. So
yeah. And with plagiarism, with poetry, is even worse because, like, they're such small pieces. And, like, you have to constantly, like, if you're thinking about this, you have to track, like, okay, when is exactly, like, did this poem or part of this poem, like, show up in the universe, like, on my Facebook page? Like, having to keep track of that for poetry, at least with a book, you have a manuscript, you can put a date on it.
Right.
You know, and it's real easy. But for all these, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of poems, like, keeping track of every little one, like, it's, you know, no one wants to do that.
No, definitely not.
But you have to.
That sounds really frustrating. But so good on you all poets for dealing with all that, because that sounds like a headache.
Yeah. So Lockhart thinks he's going to, you know, modify their memories, but they immediately disarm him.
Yeah, good on Snape for teaching that charm. So a little hat tip to him.
Yes. No, and it's just, I'm not giving anything away, but Expelliarmus tends to be Harry's go-to, like, defensive charm.
Oh, okay.
You know, to the point that some people criticize him for it, that you need to fight back a little more, because in this way, Harry is kind of like a pacifist.
Oh.
Yeah, but it's just ironic that the... one of the charms he's most known for, he basically learned from the guy he hates.
Yeah, that is interesting. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. But they march Lockhart right along to Moaning Myrtle's bathroom.
Moaning Myrtle, here we go. So, but this is like the thrill of her, I would say, life, but she's not alive. So
existence.
Yeah, her existence is to be asked how she died. And it says, Myrtle's whole aspect changed at once. She looked as though she had never been asked such a flattering question.
Ooh, it was dreadful, she said with relish. It happened right here. I died in this very stall. I remember it so well. I'd hidden because Oliver Hornby was teasing me about my glasses. The door was locked and I was crying, and then I heard somebody come in. They said something funny, a different language, I think it must have been. Anyway, what really got me was that it was a boy speaking, so I unlocked the door and told him to go away and use his own toilet, and then... Murder swelled importantly, her face shining. I died.
So then we find out that she just remembers seeing a great big yellow eyes. My whole body sort of seized up, and then I was floating away. She looked dreamily at Harry. And then I came back again. I was determined to haunt Olive Hornby, you see. Oh, she was sorry she'd ever laughed at my glasses. Oh, she'd be sorry if she ever laughed at my glasses. And then Harry continues to ask her about where she saw the eyes, and somewhere there, and pointing toward the sink in front of her toilet.
Yep.
Very gross.
Yeah. And so Harry speaks Parseltongue, and poof, the chamber's entrance is revealed.
So I have a question about this Parseltongue situation here, because he kind of stumbles with it a little bit, but is it, so he just like has to like will it to come out? Cause it's not like you speak several languages. If you just started talking to me in a different language, I mean, I probably have overthought how this works. But he's essentially just talking and like maybe thinking to himself, like, I'm talking to a snake right now. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Like, again, when you have to switch languages, because when you're in a certain linguistic, you know, language environment, your brain has, you know, socially programmed itself to function in that particular language. And so it can take a while for someone to like kind of, you know, naturally change that and be like, okay, I gotta use this language now. I gotta use this language now for this specific person. It's happened to me, like, switching between Turkish and Arabic, where sometimes, again, you know, I was working, like, with Turkish speaking or Turkish learning students, and now I've shifted to Arabic, and I'm not gonna lie that there is a point where I mixed up my Arabic and Turkish, because I was just, you know, my brain was in, like, Turkish mode, and it's taken a while to, like, fully go back to Arabic mode. Because, like, my languages don't die, but they sleep. And so, for Harry, like, his Parseltongue was sleeping.
It's just, and thank you. I'm glad there's a linguistic person on the podcast to kind of help me better understand that. Because it's, I guess it's like, it's natural to him. Like he didn't have to like study it. It's just innate. So interesting. Interesting that that is coming in handy right now to talk to the basilisk. I think I said that right.
Yeah. And so basically they shove Lockhart in first, going to sacrifice him first.
Can't blame him really at this point. Everybody's pissed off at Lockhart.
Although I'm thinking like they're 12 year olds. Like they don't know what the hell they're doing.
Right.
But just the
right.
sense of, yeah, that Lockhart at this point, if the basilisk were to really show up, like Lockhart is more trouble than he's worth. It's not like Lockhart is bound by any sense of morality. Like they already know that he was going to modify their memories.
Yes. True.
So yeah, just interesting. Were they hoping to use him as like a diversion if that was necessary? And who cares if the basilisk kills Lockhart?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what their intentions were. It's not like they needed him there for moral support or whatever. He's just, yeah, I don't know what their intention was.
Yeah, again, interesting. But so basically they're kind of in this sort of cavernous, like cave-like passageway.
And they're kind of assuming this is under the lake at this point, and they're getting through this tunnel and they
end covered up, in skeletons.
Yes, covered in skeletons. And they kind of come upon this giant snake skin.
Yeah, which just is able to reiterate the sheer size of this thing.
Yeah. Now this size of snake, I don't think I would be like too psyched to run into.
Although there were anacondas in the prehistoric age who did get this big.
Who? Glad I was not around then.
Yeah, like it's crazy like how big, you know, animals were. Not just dinosaurs, like Megalodon, the giant shark, like, you know, dire wolves. Like, you know, I don't know why evolution was such that things started huge and then they got smaller and smaller.
Yeah, that's a great, I don't know that either. I would like to ask somebody why that is. I'm just now I'm fixated on a giant snake. So sorry.
Yeah. And then, of course, Lockhart, first chance he gets, you know, grabs Ron's wands and is like, the adventure ends here, boys. He said, I shall take a bit of this skin back up to the school and tell them I was too late to save the girl and that you two tragically lost your minds at the sight of her mangled body. Say goodbye to your memories.
Lockhart being a dick, and the wand, thankfully he grabbed Ron's wand, so it basically exploded with the force of a small bomb. Harry flung his arm over his head, slipping over the coils of snake skin. Basically, thank God he grabbed Ron's wand because it didn't really go as planned.
Yeah, and I think this, again, up to this point, Lockhart has been portrayed as just like a quote-unquote harmless narcissist, but this shows the true depravity of, yeah, it's not the greatest thing that, you know, he plagiarizes and steals other people's work, but that's like, again, a non-violent crime, again, depending on how much, you know, we infer that how much memory charms can mentally harm people. But here it's really showing that I am prepared to like have you guys basically go insane to keep my persona.
Right. Yeah. He is willing to do kind of the worst to save his own ass, which we shouldn't be surprised by.
Two 12-year-old children.
Exactly. He's going to sacrifice children. And also, you know, Jenny, probably. She's down there just to save his own ass.
Yeah. But then, you know, the explosion of the wand causes a cave-in with a bunch of rocks, and Harry and Ron end up on opposing sides.
Yeah.
And then Harry decides, I'm going to go ahead.
Of course.
I'll be back in an hour. If not, ..
Yeah. If not, good luck. I'll try to shift some of the rocks, he said, so you can get back through. And Harry, see you in a bit. They try to, like, play it cool at this point. Yeah. But off he goes to the tunnel.
Yeah, just another, like, you know, Sorcerer's Stone deal. No, you know, no biggie.
Right, yeah. Yes.
And so Harry comes upon another, like, door, and it's, like, covered in stone snakes. And it doesn't take Harry too much to imagine, and says, open, in Parseltongue. and the serpents parted and the wall cracked open. The halves slid smoothly out of sight and Harry, shaking from head to foot, walked inside.
And then I had to stop reading, everybody, because Amy won't let me read ahead. So I don't know what happened.
Was it a temptation?
I mean, I really did want to know what happened, but I was like, I am not going to break my promise. So I did not. But yes, it is to the point where I was like, oh my gosh, I need to know what happens. So
yeah, but that means, you know, just two more chapters.
Yeah. And
then crazy. We'll be done with Chamber of Secrets.
Wild. So, I am surprised that this book gets so much dislike so far, because I think it's been super enjoyable.
I guess I'm being unfair to the people who... It's not so much that it's bad, but again, I think it's a testament that the other books are so, so good.
Yeah. Yeah. When I stopped reading those chapters, I was like, this has been, I mean, it's dark and fun. So I guess the other ones just must be so, so good. So,
yep. All righty then. Shall we move to Gothic Geek Out?
Yes. Let's do
okay.
It.
What gothic elements came up for you?
I'm going to go with my favorite creature in the world. The spiders were kind of gothic. And just because, not necessarily the creature itself, but I feel like if we're going to read any sort of gothic literature, a presence of spiders is always mentioned, because cobwebs are there, or, you know, the kind of word skittering spider just kind of doesn't, it's never like a something that gives you a warm fuzzy. It's always something that leaves you with a little bit of, it's always a little unsettling to read that. So Aragog and his spider crew, that is my most gothic element. How about you?
My most gothic element, the Chamber of Secrets itself.
That is a good one.
Secret passageways, secret rooms and tunnels under the castle, which castle is already gothic in of itself.
Yes.
Fact that you can only get into the secret room via a secret password or a special magic.
Pretty gothic elements right there. Yeah, it's like basically a gothic manor. It's the Chamber of Secrets.
Exactly. That was my big thing, but yeah. Spiders. Just innately, they go hand in hand with gothic, because spiders by nature, as Aragog pointed out, like the dark and the quiet, and that so often ends up being the atmosphere of the gothic setting, be it the rural countryside or the urban paranormal fantasy.
Yeah, it's just, they're always kind of there, even if they're not.
Alrighty then, shall we do Tarot of the Day?
Let's do it.
Okay, I'm shuffling. Okay, The World.
The World? That's a good card, right?
Yeah, card number 21 in the Major Arcana.
Okay. I'm looking up the word right now.
Yeah, I'm looking it up now. Let's see. When the World card appears in a tarot reading, you are glowing with a sense of wholeness, achievement, fulfillment, and completion. A long-term project, period of study, relationship, or career has come full circle, and you are now reveling in the sense of closure and accomplishment. This card could represent graduation, a marriage, birth of a child, or achieving long-held dream or aspiration. You have finally accomplished your goal or purpose. I think of, you know, just the whole finding the piece of paper in Hermione's hand that basically answers all of the questions about what the creature is.
That's a really smart way to look at that, because I was going to be like, "Whoop! This is the first time I'm going to say it. This doesn't apply." But yeah, that's a great. It's like figuring out the key to all this stuff that they have been trying to figure out for the past year.
Yeah, and now it's finally come full circle. Like, not in a positive way, but the cyclical nature of this quote unquote mystery, nearly all of it has been solved at this point.
Yeah, the kind of the end of the big project. What the heck is the Chamber of Secrets? What's the creature down there? What's going on? So that makes sense.
Yeah. If loose ends still remain, the World card asks you to bring them to completion. In doing so, you will clear the space for new beginnings and opportunities to emerge. So yeah, just the notion of going in and solving the mystery and saving the day.
That's what Harry's on his way to do, right? He is going to tie up those loose ends. Right.
Yes.
Cool.
And how bloody will that be? Let's see.
Oh, what? How bloody? Oh, God.
Yes. Alrighty then. So that was tarot. And now let me grab my runes.
All right.
Okay. I'm shaking them, shaking them. Okay, let's see. I'm picking one. I'm picking... Oh, it's a single line, which I know is the vertical line. So I know that this is, I forget its name, but I know it stands for like I, specifically like ice.
Okay, okay.
So let me pull up my little description. Let's see. No, Kendall, I don't want Sheridan Le Fanu. I want my rune book. My rune book that I have like on my Kindle, like that's literally the first book I bought on Kindle, and I bought it by accident because I didn't know what the hell I was doing with Kindle.
Oh, wow. Nothing wrong with that.
Okay. Esau. That is the name of the rune. Again, translation, ice. Keywords, obstacle, standstill, stagnation, delay, and coldness.
Hmm.
Essa is the third rune in Hegel's Et, and the third in a row to carry a predominantly negative meaning. It translates literally to ice, which may seem, depending on the context, to be a neutral or even positive substance to modern people. But to ancient people of Northern Europe, ice was useless and was more often than not an obstacle. As a representation of frozen water, Essa signifies a lack of movement, which is likely frustrating. There may be physical circumstances blocking your progress, a loss of energy, or mental blocks that you cannot see past in order to move forward. Essa also indicates delay, and it is the best to accept that as a reality. And it is best to accept this as a reality in your current situation rather than pushing against it. Know that the sun will eventually return and melt the ice and allow the water to flow freely again.
Well, I feel like this one is pretty easy to like pull from this book, but I want to know what you think.
Again, the notion of obstacles, like it's, again, literally thinking of a wall, it made me think of like the wall of spiders.
Oh, yeah.
That was loud.
That's, sorry, it really scared me.
Yeah, that they, you know, turn around to see once they're done talking to Aragog. But yeah, obstacles, like in this case, you know, they're figuring a lot of stuff out. But so, and I think the best way to interpret delay in this chapter, they are delayed in a variety of ways. You know, it takes them a while to finally get out into the forest to talk to Aragog. They're delayed because going into the chamber, they're delayed by Lockhart trying to save his own ass and the wall caving in. And so that's a physical wall that's between Ron and Harry.
True. I took it as the interpretation I took was the petrification of like Hermione. And I know it was just because to be frozen, and they said it was not like a very positive rune. Sorry. I almost said card. That's kind of where I went with it. Being trapped in that state with all these people. And that's kind of the beginning of the whole journey, is because of the people being frozen. So I feel like mine was a little, I don't know, that's what I took from that pull. So yeah. I feel like it's interesting. I feel like I always struggle with the runes usually, and the tarot makes a little more sense. This week I felt the opposite.
Yeah, because obstacles definitely for Gilderoy Lockhart, like an obstacle to his cowardice is he's being bullied and coerced by 2 12-year-olds.
Yeah, that's kind of hard.
Which goes to show that just Lockhart cannot, like, whether physically or magically, he cannot defend himself. Like, he is just not a warrior or dueler in any way, shape, or form. All the success that he has gleaned has been through schmoozing and manipulation and, like, political intrigue. Like, it's, like, to have to physically or magically fight anyone, he just can't do it.
Right, yes. And I think there are a lot of people out there who... You know, it's their mouth is, they live by the opposite of, you know, like, action speaks louder than words. They're just like, words speak louder than action. So they just.
Or it's even just the notion again, like, you know, there are positive elements of that sort of archetype of the non-fighter, like Tyrion, sure, Lannister, who has the whole spiel about, you know, my brother has his sword and I have my mind.
Hey, I am never going to knock Tyrion Lannister. So I like that character a lot from what I remember of the show because I haven't read the books. But yeah, absolutely. I think just as long as there's some honesty and dignity with it and it's not purely manipulation, I don't know.
Yeah, but yeah, that's all I can think of. But I think that was a good one for these chapters.
I agree. I think it was too.
Okay, then. And now we move on to fan fiction time.
Gosh, okay. I think that the part of these two chapters that like I was hyper-focused on was the spiders and the snakes and the kind of how they were at odds. So what if Aragog was like in cahoots with the basilisk? I wonder how that would have worked out.
Well, again, it depends on the idea of the whole idea. The basilisk is only attacking Muggleborns. So would they be in a position to just want to kill Ron and Harry? Because again, we'll learn later in this series that purebloods are very, very limited in this society. So for someone who is preaching a sort of purist, like no Muggleborns, like because of their ideology and what they promote, they're not in a position to exterminate purebloods like Ron, even if they don't agree with them ideologically.
Okay, yeah.
So I'm just thinking that if Aragog was in cahoots with the basilisk, that he would somehow march them into the chamber to basically drop them in the chamber, and then everything would go from there.
Yeah, so we could have skipped over all that. I was also thinking, as you were talking through that I feel like there wouldn't be much of a Hogwarts left if that was the case. I feel like it would be an old, like, abandoned castle because they're kind of just chowing down on students, which is horrible. But horrible way to say that. But
yeah, well, one would think that the Ministry of Magic would intervene by that point. But
I guess I would hope so.
I was kind of the opposite of what if Aragog had proved more useful.
Maybe I would be like cool with spiders if that were the case, because that would be interesting if he like, what if he would have given them information and they could have helped Hagrid be released or kind of that.
Yeah. Like what if like, you know, what if Aragog had offered, come, I will go with you to the school. I will speak to whoever I need to like give my information and bridge this gap so no one has to be arachnophobic anymore.
I would have been all for that. I think that's a great direction. It would have helped a lot of people. So I really would have appreciated that take on it. But unfortunately, his role is to continue to terrify those of us who don't really enjoy spiders. So I would have liked to see him be a little bit more of a benevolent creature. Sorry, end of day. Rather than just kind of saying, "Oh, screw Hagrid, let's have a good time with these guys." So.
Aragog, if anything, he is wholly neutral. Like he doesn't bother anyone, but if you step into his territory, like you know, all bets are off.
Yeah, that's interesting because it's not, I know the Forbidden Forest is the Forbidden Forest for a reason, and his like family can get around the castle, but otherwise he's just kind of chilling and living his old life back there.
Yeah, chilling it out in retirement.
Yeah, in spider retirement. How weird.
Essentially.
Yeah.
And I also thought of another one. Again, what if Lockhart had not gone with them?
You know, do you think they may have made progress a little more quickly since they didn't have to deal with him? And I just thought of something else, too, when you're talking about Lockhart. But is that kind of what you would have thought, that they, maybe they would have gotten?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, basically, again, some people kind of criticize certain elements of plot holes in, you know, Chamber of Secrets. But one thing is that with it happening this way, it forces the situation where Harry has to go battle the evil himself.
Yes, it does. It does.
Mm-hmm. Whereas if Lockhart had not been there, then probably he and Ron would not have gotten separated.
Yeah. So Lockhart, as usual, is was a hindrance. And if he would not have been there, that would have been much more helpful. The thing that you made me think of when we were talking about Lockhart is, what if, you know, he got all this hell from these teachers and it proved that he actually did know what he was talking about? Like, he was actually legit. I think that would have been interesting as well.
Yeah, well, I think it would be interesting. Like, that would have been a repetition of Snape's whole deal, that Snape's an asshole, but he's not pure evil.
Yeah.
Like, that kind of would have been a repetition of, okay, Lockhart is a pain in the butt, but he's not wholly useless.
Yeah. Yeah, you kind of got to play your characters right there.
Mm-hmm. Or another, it would have been so nice. What if Harry and Ron had gone to McGonagall?
Oh, wow.
Because in a way, like, it's not like, oh, you children will take care of this. Like, McGonagall would have to take Harry with her because he's the only one who speaks Parseltongue.
Right, right.
So, like, whether it was McGonagall herself or a few band teachers, like, they would have had to take Harry with them.
Do you think she would have, like, gotten the whole crew to go out there, and or would it have just been McGonagall and Harry? I think she would have had everybody. I think it would have been a group effort.
I think it would have been a group effort, at least with, I think, the four heads of house. I want the dream team of McGonagall, Snape, Sprout, and Flitwick.
I would have loved that. I think that would have been a lot more fun. And I think, you know, sure, we had to take care of Lockhart, but this would have been an enjoyable.
Yeah, or maybe, yeah, maybe something else would happen that would have separated the teachers from Harry, and Harry would have had to go face the bad evil anyway.
Maybe.
Yeah. But anyway, lots of scenarios that could have panned out, but they stupidly go for Lockhart.
Of course. Of course.
Alrighty then, and thus concludes chapters 15 and 16 of The Chamber of Secrets. Tune in next time, guys, and we will be going over the final chapters, 17 and 18, which is The Heir of Slytherin and Dobby's Reward. And joining us for that episode next week will be my sister, Holly Jensen.
Excited to meet Holly.
Yes, and so, yeah, she'll be joining us from time to time with some Rambling Ravenpuffs episode. If you want to hear about my sister and I rambling about Jane Austen novels, go check out the mini podcast series Sublimely Austen, available wherever you get your podcast.
Yes, go check that out for sure.
Yeah. All right, then. See you all next week. Bye.